Blog Talk Radio.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruption. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading the charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on report from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry R. Woman Liberationist and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
Welcome to another edition of Your World News. I'm your host, Solomon. Shortly, we'll be joined by Andrea Zamudio, who is Your World News is a managing editor for our online site. You can simply go there by going to your internet and typing in www.yourworldnews.org. That's yourworldnews.org. No special spelling, no Z at the end of news. It's just yourworldnews.org, yourworldnews.org. And the individual who had the first word in this show today was the late, great Gil Scott-Heron, who passed away a couple days ago, and he will be, sorely missed. He was one of the great, poets, spoken word artists of our time. And, he played a major role in my social upliftment in a number of ways. I can remember the first time I heard the revolution that would be televised, and I was nothing but a young prepubescent boy, and that song, really struck a chord with me even at a young age, and we could only hope that more of our rappers and entertainers, could follow the path that Gil Scott-Heron did in terms of using the platform that he was given as an artist to raise the specter of consciousness, critical consciousness, in a number of ways. And so, you know, bless you, Gil Scott-Heron. You know, I know you're in a better place right now with the Most High, and your work that you did on planet Earth will never be in vain. You know, it lives on in individuals like me and so many millions of others throughout the globe. So, you know, this show is dedicated to Your World News. I mean, this Your World News program is dedicated to the likes of Gil Scott-Heron, and as you'll soon find out, many of our fallen freedom fighters and liberators, and also those who have lost their lives by way of police brutality, the Sean Bells, the Oscar Grants, the Ayanna Stanley Joneses, the Timothy Stansberrys, Oscar Grant, the Patrick Dorisman. I mean, we can go on, you know, Trey Joyner, Delonte Rawlings. You know, this program is for you. This is who we have chosen to memorialize this 30th day of May 2011. And so before I welcome Andre on, I want to start the show. I want this piece that I'm about to play here by Dr. Dalia Wasfi to set the stage, because I think that this soundbite from a speech that she gave was right on time, and I think it sets the stage for what we're going to discuss in this program today. So without further ado, you know, this is Your World News. The call-in number is 347-945-5191. That's 347-945-5191. This is Dr. Dalia Wasfi. I'll see you in about 2 minutes, but listen really close. And Andre, you too. As you're about to join us, Andre, I want you to listen loud and clear. I want everyone to listen loud and clear to the words that the sister put down. It's right on time. Right on time.
We have an obligation to every last victim of this illegal aggression, because all of this carnage has been done in our name. Since World War II, 90% of the casualties of war are unarmed civilians, a third of them children. Our victims have done nothing to us. From Palestine to Afghanistan to Iraq to Somalia to wherever our next target may be, their murders are not collateral damage. They are the nature of modern warfare. They don't hate us because of our freedom. They hate us because every day we are funding and committing crimes against humanity. The so-called war on terror is a cover for our military aggression to gain control of the resources of Western Asia. This is sending the poor of this country to kill the poor of those Muslim countries. This is trading blood for oil. This is genocide. And to most of the world, we are the terrorists. In these times, remaining silent on our responsibility to the world and its future is criminal. And in light of our complicity in the supreme crimes against humanity in Iraq and Afghanistan and ongoing violations of the UN Charter and international law, how dare any American criticize the actions of legitimate resistance to illegal occupation? Our so-called enemies in Afghanistan, Iraq, Palestine, our other colonies around the world, and our inner cities here at home are struggling against the oppressive hand of empire, demanding respect for their humanity. They are labeled insurgents or terrorists for resisting rape and pillage by the white establishment, but they are our brothers and sisters in the struggle for justice. The civilians at the other end of our weapons don't have a choice, but American soldiers have choices. And while there may have been some doubt 5 years ago, today we know the truth. Our soldiers don't sacrifice for duty, honor, country. They sacrifice for Kellogg, Brown, and Root. They don't fight for America. They fight for their lives and their buddies beside them, because we put them in a war zone. They're not defending our freedom. They're laying the foundation for 14 permanent military bases to defend the freedoms of ExxonMobil and British Petroleum. They're not establishing democracies. They're establishing the basis for an economic occupation to continue after the military occupation has ended. Iraqi society today, thanks to American help, is defined by house raids, death squads, checkpoints, detentions, curfews, blood in the streets, and constant violence. We must dare to speak out in support of the Iraqi people who resist and endure the horrific existence we brought upon them through our bloodthirsty imperial crusade. We must dare to speak out in support of those American war resistors, the real military heroes, who uphold their oath to defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, including those terrorist cells in Washington, D.C., more commonly known as the legislative, executive, and judicial branches. Frederick Douglass says, "Those who profess to favor freedom and yet depreciate agitation are people who want crops without plowing the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the roar of its many waters. The struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, or it may be both, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never will. Every one of us must keep demanding, keep fighting, keep thundering, keep plowing, keep speaking, keep struggling until justice is served. No justice, no peace." No.
Yes, and that was Dr. Dalia Wasfi, and I thought it was right on time. And I heard that her speech a while ago. It just jumped into my head. I said, you know, this is something that we have to play today. So, you know, as I welcome in Andrea Zamudio, who, as I said before, is the managing editor for Your World News. You know, this is our Memorial Day tradition. And as you know, we also have a so-called Independence Day tradition, you know, in which we pay homage to the precedents that were set before us by the late, great Frederick Douglass, when he gave that Independence Day speech in Rochester, New York, long, long, long time ago. And, we will continue to use that so-called holiday as a call to call out the hypocrisies of this American democracy, in hopes to raise the consciousness of so many more others, even if it's just a critical consciousness amongst a critical mass. This is what this show is for. Memorial Day. So I'm gonna welcome on Andrea, and then we'll talk a little bit about the historical context of Memorial Day, and we'll get into why we haven't drank the American Kool-Aid, the Americanized Kool-Aid, in which you know, as I was watching this morning, I saw, you know, even just watching on ESPN, just trying to catch some of the scores of the insignificant games that are played on the professional realm. Insignificant when we look at what's going on, the death and destruction that's going on in this world. Professional sports is insignificant by a long shot. But it just, you know, going through on ESPN, you know, you see they have this little montage where ESPN is paying homage to Memorial Day, and you know, one of the things I jotted down, you know, they had, you know, an individual on there saying, you know, this Memorial Day is for the sacrifice that soldiers made for the U.S. The sacrifice, really, the sacrifice that was made by U.S. soldiers for the U.S. Yeah, we're going to revisit that. So, Andrea, welcome to the show, and if you can, open up and maybe give us, you know, some brief comments in terms of what Memorial Day means to you. And you know, and no one here, you know, can say that they haven't ever fallen victim to getting caught up in certain holidays. It's about, you know, we've all have had our watershed moments where we've learned things outside the box and have seen, you know, a lot more clarity when it comes to certain holidays. And for me, it was hip hop, it was Public Enemy, it was, you know, it was Flavor Flav way back in the day, you know, saying picture us cool on the 4th of July. And if you heard we were celebrating, that was a worldwide lie. That was one of the tidbits of information that was given to me by folks that are elders in my life, as well as entertainers of the golden era of hip-hop that helped elevate my critical consciousness in terms of how I looked at so-called holidays and so forth. So unless someone's from a different planet or whatever, I mean, there's very few who can say that they were born into this world and always looked at these propagandist holidays for what they are. It's just propaganda. So with that being said, Andrea, you can, you know, give us your thoughts in terms of, I mean, surely you, and even if we haven't celebrated these holidays, you know, we haven't always thought of them as what they are, you know. If you can just give us your two cents in terms of what Memorial Day means to you in 2010, you know, not what it meant to you, you know, 20 years ago when it probably didn't mean anything, but what it means to you now that you require the information and the due diligence that goes into paying attention to what's going on in the world. What does Memorial Day mean to you in this 2011 where war is running rampant all over the place, from Libya to Afghanistan to Pakistan and beyond?
Good afternoon, Solomon. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you loud and clear.
Okay. It's great to be with you and all the listeners today. I think this is a great opportunity to talk about a lot of the people that are not included in our history books that fought against imperialism, colonization, and now neocolonization. That speech that you just played was, you know, it was incredible, and I think it's definitely what today should be about, memorializing people who have been caught in the crosshairs of these wars, people who have nothing to do with this, with the expansion of capitalism in the United States, the 1.5 million deaths that have been innocent civilians in Iraq that aren't talked about. And as Just Foreign Policy mentions, that's 10 times greater than what's usually shown in the U.S. media. And so I think that Memorial Day is about that, about exposing what's actually happening around the world due to U.S. foreign policy and these lives that are lost. Dr. Wasifi just mentioned in her speech, that they're not collateral damage. Just one person, one innocent person dying in a war should be memorialized, and with much more reason, 1.5 million alone in Iraq, I think is a reason to, mention these lives that are lost. So to me, it's about that, everything that you've mentioned from foreign policy to domestic policy, you know, like police brutality, racial profiling, all these types of things that are occurring, but we don't see in the news. So it's about that, and it's about talking about our fallen soldiers who have fought for liberation of people in the United States and outside of the United States from oppression from the U.S. government.
Right. And, Dr. Wasfi, she set the stage, but the stage has been set in so many other ways by folks that came before all of us. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to dissect Memorial Day. I think at about half past the hour, we may be getting a special phone call from Stephen Lindman from Chicago, who has been on RT the last couple of days discussing everything from the U.S. U.S. seems to be encircling Russia with its plans to build a so-called defense shield in Eastern Europe. And he is one of the most prolific, you know, activist writers out there right now. And I believe he's going to be calling in to discuss his latest piece that he wrote. It's posted on Your World News on our blog site. Just go to yourworldnews.org and then click on blogs on the blogs tab, and it'll take you right there. He's going to be discussing, you know, for a few minutes his perspective on Memorial Day. And you know, to set the stage for a deeper context before we even get into the fallen freedom fighters and liberators, it's important to kind of look at you know, what Memorial Day has come to mean for so many Americans who have yet to, I guess, you know, take the blue pill, if you want to make the reference to the Matrix. it was a day that was first observed, Memorial Day. It was first observed in 1866, and it was called Decoration Day in 1868. And in 1967, it became a federal law, as many of us know, to honor America's fallen men and women. And then we even look at Veterans Day, which it's always closely aligned with. And Veterans Day used to be called Armistice Day, Day of Remembrance. If you reside in Europe, commemorating the end of World War I on the 11th hour, 11th day of the 11th month in 1918, and it was first observed in the U.S. in 1919. That's Veterans Day. Became a legal holiday in 1938, and in June of 1954, the Congress changed its name to Veterans Day. Now, giving that context, when we look around on TV, Andrea, we see, you know, a lot of these commemorations. If you're unfortunate to be in a town where there's a parade going on right now, I said unfortunate because that's the last thing I'd want to see. Is the propagandist, like, you know, flag waving, walking through the street, because there's no context. There's never, and obviously it's, I mean, I'm stating the obvious. It's very purposeful that there's no context to this holiday. So there's no discussion about these wars, many of these wars, which were waged based on what? They were waged based on a military-industrial complex. They were waged on imperialism. They resulted in the destruction of literally tens of millions of lives. When we look, you know, at you know, since the end of World War II. Wars that the U.S. is being engaged in, the vast majority of casualties, deaths, over 90% of them have been civilians, and so it's this is a context that's never really talked about. You know why? And we look at Vietnam, looking at, you know, poor you know, white boys, poor black. Latino, Chicano soldiers being sent over there to fight in a war of imperialism, a war of conquest, a war of the U.S. not liking how another country is governing itself, and so especially since they're governing themselves under the umbrella of communism, wanting to go over there and. Regardless of how many thousands of lives that it's going to take from U.S. soldiers, and it was over 58,000 lives, U.S. soldiers' lives, but then even greater was the 3 million, the 1.5 to 3 million Vietnamese lives that were destroyed, the countless lives in Cambodia and Laos, the bombs, the napalm, you know, you know, all those things are not discussed. Like, what, you know, so when I hear these things on ESPN, as I heard this morning, and I see these things plastered all over the place, regardless of what channel you turn to, you know, the sacrifice for U.S., they weren't sacrificing. They may have thought they were sacrificing, and that's the whole propaganda behind it. Undoubtedly, right now, there are young men and women right now who have been programmed, who have been mindlessly programmed to believe that their enlistment in the U.S. Armed Forces, is somewhat has something to do with freedom and democracy and fighting, you know, fighting this this war on terror. I mean, which is completely absurd, fighting a war on an ideology, which is like a brilliant move by the Bush regime, carried out by now by the Obama regime. It's because you declare war on an ideology. I mean, boom, you don't. I mean, that to masses of programmed people, that means that completely is going to become a war with no end in sight. And that's why people have to take the blue pill and understand what's going on so that we can wield this, you know, demand, not request, but demand, and end these wars of aggression. But that's what's going on now, just as in the Vietnam War, except in the Vietnam War, we saw the draft, but now it's very much like it's a poverty draft. And so many young men and women are going into the military, even especially right now in this global recession, depression in some areas, and certainly same thing with the U.S., depression in some areas and in other areas, at the very least, recession, I should say, where they're enlisting in the Army, the Navy, the Marines, the Air Force, based on what? Based on their social or socioeconomic conditions that they find themselves living in. No access to higher education, bills up to the neck, wanting to escape poverty. And you couple that with a propaganda that has programmed them to think that they're fighting some kind of noble war. But really, Andrea, this war is a war that is for the Halliburtons and their subsidiaries like Kellogg, Brown, and Root. This war is for the Bechtels, the Lockheed Martins, the Raytheons, the mm-hmm. Triple Canopy. I mean, and we can go on and on. That is what this war is for. And those on Capitol Hill who benefit from these wars and benefit from the guise of fear that is out there that keeps them in power, because so many were elected and reelected because of power, and so many have been made into heroes because of the fear, such as the devil himself, one of the devils, Rudolph Giuliani. Would you say that? Would you concur with that, Andrea? Or and if not, what are your thoughts?
No, absolutely. I find it interesting that a lot of people today out there celebrating are talking about how people have gone to foreign countries to fight for our freedoms. But I'd like to ask them, how many foreign military bases are on U.S. soil? So how many military bases do other countries have in the United States? None. Why? Because that would never happen. That's not acceptable. However, the United States has 700, close to 1,000 military bases all around the world. And so how is that protecting our freedom when we're invading other countries, whether it's official wars or unofficial wars or just having access to military bases? So somehow there's this double standard where that's acceptable and people still think that we're protecting our freedoms, but other people aren't allowed to protect themselves, right? So, I just find that interesting. And what you were saying about, this being a poverty draft, like, absolutely. There's this good documentary out called Yo Soy el Army that was put out by some activists in Los Angeles about the recruitment, this huge movement right now in the Pentagon to recruit Latinos, especially immigrant Latinos. And they just talk about how, the recruiters are in their schools, all the propaganda that they're pushing with advertisements on TV and around the community in East LA that are in Spanish, this continuation of drafting poor people, black and brown. And yes, you see this in white poor schools, but it's not to the same degree that you see it in, whether it's inner city or, rural areas of black and brown schools. And so, the speech in the beginning was saying is right on point. Like, you have poor people here going to fight wars against other poor black and brown people in other countries, but I don't see any of the children of congressmen, congresswomen going to fight wars across the country, which, you know, they're the ones pushing these laws and these agendas, and they're so adamant about the about that, then how come, you know, their children aren't sent off to fight for our freedoms, so they say.
Right. And some of them, I mean, the most lily-livered, like, punks out there. I mean, you know, some of these folks that are in Congress, you know, couldn't fight themselves out of a wet paper bag, you know, if their life depended on it. And yet, but they can stand, you know, with all the trappings of taxpayer dollars that are paying for their wonderful insurance for them and their families, but yet they can vote on appropriations to send, you know, to dole out more and more money, tens and tens of billions of dollars of more money through congressional appropriations for wars. But at the same time, it's going to tell their constituents and going to launch these mass propaganda schemes to tell folks that, you know, universal health care is just going to drain the budget. It's going to whatever. That, you know, that's not what's going to drain the budget. That's not what's draining the budget. It's the military. It's the military expenditure. It is the
right.
military expenditure which is draining the budget. But they can hide there on Capitol Hill, go there in their suits and don't even have to worry about even getting in a scrap, even a fist fight, let alone strapping up and going into Kandahar, going into North Waziristan, you know, or going into Basra, or going into Fallujah. You understand? These little punks, you know, can just sit there and not even worry about, you know, the vast majority of them don't have to worry about their kids being sent there or anything of that nature. But yet they want to, you know, they want to send masses of people to fight in a war that they wouldn't even fight. If it came down to it, they would flee. Mm-hmm. They would haul ass and flee to Canada or Finland or someplace else where it was a safe haven for them to hide with their tails between their legs. It's disgusting. It's disgusting. Mm-hmm. And the corporate media has no pundits whatsoever that can step up. Not damn MSNBC. So people stop it. MSNBC has exposed itself. It's a friggin' joke. It is a joke. The people that are paraded on there that are supposed to be, you know, that are supposed to be, you know, so-called, you know, liberal. What the hell is a liberal anyway? You know, a liberal is nothing more than an individual who the vast majority of the time wants to place a damn Band-Aid on a scar that goes from your neck all the way down to your wrist, you know,
mm-hmm.
and wants to turn its head away from the roots of the disease and the cause. You know, so when I you know, back when the U.S. started its bombing campaign in March 19th in Libya, that following week you saw the likes of Rachel Maddow and Ed Schultz both banging the war drums that yes, this is the right move. This is the right move for the U.S. to bomb, to send Tomahawk missiles at the tune of between $1 and $1.5 million a piece. Over 200 of them sailing into different parts of Libya indiscriminately. And don't talk about the so-called soft targets or the collateral damage that was caused by those. Don't talk about that whatsoever. They are just as culpable in that murder as Barack Obama and Robert Gates, Leon Panetta, and all the other warmongers that hang out in their caves in Washington, whether it's 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue or at the Pentagon or some other place. They are
mm-hmm.
just culpable because they have the large platform and they don't have the guts and to speak out against their military-industrial complex current contract, which is General Electric. So if they do is they bang the war drums, knowing that their parent companies for MSNBC is one of the largest military contractors in the world, and that is General Electric. So they sit there, and they're little obsequious viewers who have not been trained to deconstruct dominant narratives, and so they suck up everything that's being told to them, not saying, like, damn, man, you know, like, you know, why would you be pushing war? Like, war, you know what I'm saying? War, you know, just bombing left and right. Because people are not, Andre, they're not even thinking about the casualties. And those that do think about the casualties, the collateral damage, they're the ones that see those Libyans or those Afghan civilians or those Iraqis as something different than a white Anglo-Saxon American. They see them different than that. They see them almost like a cockroach or some kind of farm animal, where it's a loss of the life of a cow or something like that is not to be mourned in the same way loss of the life of a human being is. And that's how the difference looks at those. But that's
right.
That's exactly what goes on every single day in this country, and it goes on unchecked, and we have to check it. We have to check it, whether you have access to a show like this, or if you even have access to one person in your family. You sit down and you have those tough conversations. You don't run away from them because of how tough that they might emerge into an argument or this, that, and the other. No, you have those conversations, and you have them right away. You have them today. You have them tomorrow, and you continue to have them. You continue to be that inconvenient hero. But at the end of that phrase is hero. You have those conversations, as inconvenient as they are. You are a hero in your household. You are a hero in the spoke of humanity that is continuing to roll on and on and on, and we need to build that momentum. So, so today, you know what? Not only are we gonna talk about this holiday as we've started, but as Andrea said, we are gonna talk about the likes of Che Guevara. We're gonna talk about the likes of Malcolm X, El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz. We're going to talk about Patrice Lumumba. We're going to talk about Nahanda from Zimbabwe, and as she told the British as they hung her, you know what I'm saying, and she looked in their eyes, my bones will rise again. We're going to talk about the John Browns, the Denmark Vesey's, the Gabriel Prossers. We're going to talk about the Nat Turners. We're going to talk about courageous men and women who lost their lives in battle against imperialism, against white supremacy, against chattel slavery, against colonization, and then those who use their lives, who may not have lost their lives in battle, but who use their lives as vessels while they're on this planet Earth to fight against those things, like the Ida B. Wells's, and so many others. These are the folks that we are going to memorialize today. These are the folks we're going to memorialize. And then we're going to take it a step further. We're going to memorialize those who have lost their lives to police brutality and police terror, as I spoke about. And we're also going to memorialize the fallen soldiers who were forced, through propaganda and through drafts and poverty drafts, who lost their lives unwittingly, not knowing that they were being used like pawns in a game of chess or a game of checkers by some rich, rich white men and women, to fight these wars. Because it is a sad thing when someone who thought that they were giving their lives for something noble end up losing their life, never to be again. When you lose your life, there's no coming back as far as we know it. There's no coming back on this planet Earth as far as we know it. And you lose your life and you're taken away from your loved ones, your parents, your daughters, your sons, your grandparents, your nieces, your nephews, your sisters, your brothers, and you're taken away from their lives, and that mourning that will go on for the rest of their lives. There's no coming back from that to fight in a war that you thought you were doing something noble, that you were sacrificing it for the greater good, when in essence you were sacrificing it in nothing for nothing else but money, not your money, but as well as imperialism. That is what we're going to discuss. And before I ask Andrea a question in terms of the first person, to give a little context for one of the first persons that Andrea, that I want you to talk about, who you want to give a special memorial for, of remembrance to, as we say, Ashe, And in the hood, sometimes we say we pour out a little liquor for them. I want to bring us up to date on some things that happened this past week. Well, one of the things that we should mention this past week, the U.S. up to its dirty tricks again, as the U.S. has placed sanctions on Tezessa, which is the oil company, the state-owned oil company out of Venezuela, and Citgo is a subsidiary of that. And the U.S. has placed sanctions on, the U.S. government has placed sanctions on Tezessa for the reasoning that, you know, they were having dealings with Iran, who there are sanctions, not from the international community, not from the majority of the international community, but from the likes of France and Britain and the U.S. and Israel, all right, and a few others. But beyond that, you know, that's the international community that the U.S. always like to talk about. But those are the things, those are the justifications for the sanctions. And I might tell folks, if you didn't know this, Citgo, which is owned by the government of Venezuela, has provided 250,000 U.S. citizens in 25 states, as well as the District of Columbia, D.C., with heating oil, with a heating oil program for those who have very little economic resources. No U.S. corporation, no U.S. oil company, Exxon, Chevron, Conoco, does that. None does that. You know, and by the way, those three that's named are all part of the old Standard Oil, you know, J.D. Rockefeller, you know, assortment of oil companies. But no U.S. corporation, no U.S. oil corporation does that. But Citgo does that. And, you know, 60%, and what I'll say, what I also say is that 60% of oil profits go to social programs in Venezuela. So when Venezuela, we look at the fact that since Chavez has been in office, since Chavez came to power about 12 years ago, Venezuela has cut in half by 50%. Its poverty has cut it in half. So yes, they still have much more to go. But if the U.S. was able to do that, I mean, I would have to take my hats off to whatever president or administration launched that. The U.S. doesn't even come close to that. But you know, so cutting it in half, it goes to the illiteracy campaigns. It goes to the universal health care. Yes, they have a universal health care program in Venezuela. The U.S. still has no universal health care plan to speak of. The U.S. government and those oligarchs that rule in Washington continue to provide accommodations for the pharmaceutical industry, as well as the health insurance industry, and that's why we have no universal health care to speak of in any shape, form, or fashion, nothing even close to that. But that's one thing that we need to think about, because the U.S. corporate media is not going to talk about Venezuela or Podesta or those sanctions in that context. And this past week also, Andrea, we saw H202 in the state of Vermont coming closer to fruition. But still, we need to back off a little bit, because that's also not universal health care either, in its truest sense. The earliest it's going to be launched, hopefully, is 2014. It's a start. It's definitely a start. But right now, under the Affordable Health Care Act, it may not be launched until 2017. But we have to understand that it's not health care in its truest sense. It's still also leaves the door open for private health insurance companies, and it's more so like in an affordability thing. So it's not universal healthcare in its truest sense. So people need to like read into that. I mean, go on the web and read into that, because that's also been put out there in a half-assed way by the corporate media. But it is a start, and California looks to maybe follow in the steps. But there's a huge fight, a long fight ahead, but it's important. And I would tell people to really go online and visit Physicians for a National Healthcare Plan, which the lady in Vermont who actually launched this, she used to be the former president, but go there and they have their statements, and they break down the pros and the cons of Vermont, and they're largely in support of it, but they want people to keep things in context, that it's not a universal healthcare plan. So those are kind of some of the things that have gone on this week and kind of passed under the radar a little bit, a lot of it. But Andrea, who do you start off memorializing this 30th day of 2011 in the empire known as the U.S.?
I want to memorialize Jose Guerreño. His story really exemplifies what we're trying to explain today. He was shot down on May 5th by the Pima County Police in Arizona. The Pima County Sheriff's Department went on a raid of at least four homes as part of an investigation into alleged marijuana trafficking in a predominantly Latino community. So Jose was a 26-year-old husband and a father of two. He was a former Marine that served twice in Iraq, and his house was part of those raids. And so his story is basically, they didn't realize, they were never informed that the police was had a warrant to come into their home. They just busted in, and he had seen police outside, like in SWAT gear. He didn't know what was going on. So he had a AR-15 rifle, and so he was inside his home. He told his wife and his son to hide in the closet, and he was at the end of the hallway when the police busted into his house. And as soon as they saw him, they shot at him 71 times, and they hit him 60 times. Miraculously, he was still alive, but SWAT didn't clear the scene for about an hour and 14 minutes, so they prevented the paramedics from attempting to save his life. And the evidence shows now that, the police department was claiming that he had shot at them first, but the evidence shows that his safety was activated after he was killed, so there's no way that he could have shot at them. It's one of those things where it's incredible that because of a marijuana raid, because they thought that he might be trafficking drugs, and let it be said that they didn't find anything in his house. They didn't find any drugs in his house. But even if they had, is there ever an excuse to shoot somebody or shoot at somebody 71 times and hit them 60 times? I know we've discussed so many instances, and there have been, and unfortunately probably will be, so many more instances of police brutality. But I just want people to really think about this. Like, is this ever acceptable for someone? He's a father. He was a father of two. A husband. He served twice. He served this country, twice in Iraq. And he managed to, serve this country and then come back and be killed by a police department, a racist police department, because they thought he might be trafficking marijuana. It's just incredible. And I just find it interesting, and we talked about this a little bit in our last show, but in the same area, in Tucson, Arizona, was the incident with Jared Lee Lovner. I'm not sure if I pronounced his name correctly, but the shooter that shot Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, right? And so when he was caught, he was arrested, right? He wasn't shot at 70 times when he actually killed six people and wounded 12. So I wonder why that is. Maybe, I don't know, maybe because he was white, and now he has a trial, but he's – has been evaluated and he's mentally incompetent to serve on the trial. So when does that ever occur with black men or with brown men? Somehow there's no trial and they just get put on these charges, or they're just killed because they thought that the wallet was a gun, or because they're being raided without an announcement and they're shot at 60 times. I just don't, you know what I'm saying? Like, this is just, it's beyond irony. It's just like, it's sick. And so I think that today, I personally want to memorialize him and all the other stories like his that aren't told. You didn't hear his story, you know, like on any of the major news outlets. You know, I saw it on RT, and I looked it up online and started reading a couple articles about him, and the majority were of, you know, smaller independent media outlets. So I would like to memorialize him, and I also wanted to mention that last night, in the middle of the night, NATO dropped bombs on two homes in the Nizad district in southwest Helmand province, killing two women, five girls, and seven boys. Some of these children were under 2 years of age, and additionally six people were injured. And supposedly, NATO says that they thought they were attacking an area inhabited by the Taliban, but isn't that the same thing that they always say? And they came out with some, quote, heartfelt apology. Like, what is your apology after you've killed someone's children? What does it matter? They're gone. And so how many times does this have to happen that you're going to apologize and you're going to say, oh, I'm sorry, we just dropped a bomb on your children, but it was a mistake? Would that be acceptable if it happened in the U.S., just like how NATO killed Gaddafi's grandchildren, three of his grandchildren? Like, people can think whatever they want about Gaddafi, but just like people, there's some people who hate him. There's some people, a lot of people, who hate Barack Obama, and a lot of people who hate most of the presidents of the United States. And so would that make it reasonable for some other country to mistakenly bomb the White House and kill his children or kill his grandchildren? Of course not. So why is it acceptable when it happens in another country, when you're killing the leader of another country's grandchildren or any innocent children or human beings, period? It's not. But there's this ridiculous and sick double standard that's occurring in the world where it's okay and there's excuses, like as if just because someone, you don't like someone's policies and politics, it's okay to do whatever you want, just because you're the U.S., and that comes back to so much of that American exceptionalism. But, you know, I just hope that people really reflect on these two instances, and like I said, these instances just represent examples of so many other situations that have occurred.
Right, and, you know, for those that don't know, Helmand Province is in Afghanistan. There are 34 provinces within the country of Afghanistan that used to be part of actually India before it was broken up, you know, by the British, in the same way Pakistan used to be part of India before it was, the lines of partition were drawn. But the interesting thing about Helmand Province also, it's the world's largest opium producing region, and it's responsible about 42 to 44% of the world's total opium production, you know, that's a whole other story. I don't even want to go down, you know, but the connections between that and Northern Alliance, Taliban, and how opium production has continued to grow once again, and become emboldened and booming, you know, since the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. But, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that. But these things go on every single week. Every single week there are civilians that are killed in Afghanistan or Pakistan, either by air raids or by drones or by even night raids. So we know that there have been night raids that U.S. rogue soldiers, mindless, you know, soldiers, and that's the perfect, and when I say mindless, I mean that's the perfect soldier. You're not supposed to be a thinker. The perfect U.S. soldier is not a thinker. from the perspective of those cowards in Washington that send them over there to fight. They don't want people to think, because if those soldiers start thinking, really thinking, truly thinking, and deconstructing their actions and what they've been told they're fighting for, they may drop the guns. You know, they may drop the guns and refuse to fight. But so when I say mindless, I'm talking about the perfect U.S. soldier from the perspective of Washington. These mindless soldiers have gone in and they have done everything from doing raids, night raids where they've killed, you know, 15, 14, 13-year-old boys, the elderly, men, women. They've also dismembered bodies and taken the skulls and taken the bones as souvenirs, knelt down and had their buddies taking pictures, the same way we saw those friggin' barbarian, those animals, those cretins that took pictures of people that they were torching in Abu Ghraib prison. This is the pathology. And you know, one of the things, like when you were mentioning, Andrea, yeah, it would be totally unacceptable for some other country to come in there and bomb the White House and take out, you know, president's grandchildren or what have you, the same way the U.S. is taking out Gaddafi's. But the initial retort that you'll get from a lot of Americans, because this is how they've been narrowly programmed and shaped, is they'll say, well, Gaddafi, you know, this guy was, you know, was a killer. I mean, he was about to commit genocide on his people and this and the other. And so they're saying, you know, about to commit genocide, and they're saying that he said he was about to, you know, make the rivers run blood and this and the other, which has a lot of room for discussion within the whole credibility of those statements alone. But if we just even take it for that face value, and just say, okay, all right. Well, in that case, then it is justified for another country. Is that what you're saying? Because when you look at George Bush, he was without a doubt. I mean, when you look at the lives that he took, this was an act that was not that was never approved by Congress, nor was the bombing by Barack Obama in Libya approved by Congress. These are acts of war. Acts of war are supposed to be approved by Congress, and they weren't. They absolutely were not. And so when you look at the number of civilian lives that were taken by George Bush, as well as the number of civilian lives that were taken by that have been taken by Barack Obama since his time in, It makes whatever claims they have about Gaddafi pale in comparison. It makes whatever claims they have about Gaddafi pale in comparison. When you look at the renditions that they have orchestrated to other countries like Yemen and Egypt, where they've sent folks to be tortured, having their fingernails pulled out, waterboarding. Is just one aspect of torture that has gone on in these places. Some places in Eastern Europe, where the U.S. and CIA have these contracts to have prisoners tortured. You know, it's called rendition. You know, the U.S. You know, under this, the U.S. would be the and these leaders. You know, Bush and Wolfowitz and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice and the whole batch of them should be brought up on charges. Should be brought up on charges at the very least. Should be brought up on charges at The Hague, which is some other bullshit. When we look at the ICC, you know, they seem to only like to indict, you know, African leaders. But when it comes to Europeans, the vast majority of bloody serial killing, you know, Europeans, whether it's George Bush or Sarkozy or Tony Blair or Gordon Brown, no matter what kind of carnage that these folks do in terms of instigating these wars, that if these kind of wars were started by Libya or some other country, the U.S. and Britain and the like would intersect immediately and say that this is unjustified, and send them to the Hague. But you know, but these folks, these white folks are not being sent to the Hague. I mean, Barack Obama, you know, is not being sent to the Hague, and I have no real, true national discussion about sending these folks to the Hague, you know, where the International Criminal Court is. And so, I'm glad you brought up that point, because they just, you know, it's that double standard, and the double standard exists. Why? Because we're not thinking enough collectively as a society. We're not thinking enough. We're not raising our voice. And there are some people who know this and choose to keep their mouth shut because of fear of, you know, of losing their contract or this, that, and the other. I mean, you know, my new favorite, as I was telling somebody a couple weeks or, you know, last month, my new favorite NBA player is Chris Douglas Roberts. You know, not LeBron James, who's more concerned with his Nike contract, not any of these other folks, you know, who are more concerned with their Nike and Reebok contract, whether it's LeBron James or Kobe Bryant or Dwayne Wade, who would never think about speaking out. But Chris Douglas Roberts, he's a 6'7" swingman from place of the Milwaukee Bucks, and he spoke out after the killing of Bin Laden. He said, $1 trillion later, you know, and you see these, and you see all these Americans out there celebrating the death of Bin Laden. Does it make you feel better that 10 years later, $1 trillion later, and he had it right down to the closest estimate, man, which you know, when you look at even the Lancet, and he had it down to 900,000 and some 900,000 plus Iraqi civilians that have been killed. You know, there's different estimates. You know, the Lancet has anywhere between, I believe, you know, 500,000 to a little over a million, and then you have Iraq body count, who has a little has less than that. But Chris Douglas Roberts had a number that was much closer than what the U.S. corporate media ever puts out, and he said 900,000+ Iraqi civilians later, and tens of thousands Afghani civilians later. Are these American people out there, are they satisfied? Are they thinking about the loss of life and what it took to get one man who was alleged to be killed, you know, on that day, which he was probably, you know, dead, you know, years before that. You know, are they satisfied? And I mean, that act alone was an act of courageousness. It has already, you know, cost him, I believe, his contract with, I believe it was Champion Athletics. But he's been getting all kinds of hate, threats and from on his tweets and this, that, and the other. But he stands tall. I mean, this young brother in his early 20s, has the courage to speak out. That's what it's about. It's not being a punk or cowering down. It's that those of us who have platforms, who are entertainers, I mean, what a much better world if more folks spoke out. But, I mean, shoot, some of us don't even have those platforms. We don't even have those contracts to lose, and we still are afraid to speak out. Some of us don't even have those multi-million-dollar contracts, and we're still afraid to speak out. It should end today. It should end yesterday. The speaking out should begin, and the more, and I tell you what, the more you speak out, the more others around you will follow. Like, oh, man, Bobby spoke out. Oh, Teresa spoke out. Man, you know, I've been thinking the same thing, or I wasn't even thinking about it that way, such and such, and, I'm gonna speak out too. I mean, I'm trying to tell you, it's the U.S. is a nation of followers, oftentimes, but it starts with one courageous hero stepping out, and other folks who have been thinking about doing the same thing stepping out and following, and following the lead, and then we're all following the lead of one another. So we're all leaders and followers at the same time. That's what has to be done, and so. you know, when we think about this Memorial Day, there's so many, but, you know, I want to look at Malcolm X, who to me is none other than a prophet. He's a prophet in every sense of the word. And you look at folks who we look at as being prophets, Muhammad, Abraham, Yahshua ben Yosef, otherwise known as Jesus. Malcolm was a prophet. So was Martin. They were prophets. And they had the willingness to speak out. And knowing that speaking out in that time in the 60s was going to bring their mortality very, very, very much closer than it should have been. And they spoke out. And it cost them their lives. And they spoke out. They spoke out against these injustices. Because it's those folks that have the courageousness to speak out against these injustices that can prevent further injustices from happening, like the Sean Bells and the Amadou Diallos. Because when we build that critical consciousness and we start to change public policy, we start to change how policing is done so that we don't have a SWAT team going into Arizona and going in there and murdering a man for alleged, marijuana possession. When we have those folks in high places speaking out, it builds this consciousness where we see. But right now, the culture is, what's the culture? The culture is that, boom, a Mexican man, a black man, an African man gets a little beautiful African princess, Ayanna Stanley Jones gets murdered by the police in Detroit, Michigan, and we let the cops off. Because police, those that wear uniforms, the boys in blue, and the girls in blue, they're doing a noble cause. They're out there to protect and serve. They're out there to protect and serve. Yeah, that's what it is. And so, what we're gonna do is, at the very least, we're just gonna give them a little time off, or we might just suspend them for a little while. But meanwhile, this little girl is dead. There is no justice right now for the victims of police murder and police terror. And so my hats go off to Malcolm X, Al-Haj, Malik El-Shabazz. My hats goes off to Martin Luther King, those folks that spoke out. And those who were willing also to take up arms, knowing that taking up arms was probably going to lose them their life. But you know what? They took the option that they would rather die on their feet than to live on their knees. And those are the likes of Nat Turner, Denmark Vesey, Gabriel Prosser, the Africans of the Stonewall Rebellion in South Carolina, the many Africans that rebelled in Brazil, the Cimarroons, the Maroons, Those are people, Emiliano Zapata, Pancho Villa. I mean, these are the folks that should be memorialized. Because when you memorialize, Andrea, these folks, what you do is you create a critical consciousness. So the same way you have all these little kids who are lined up in their Boy Scout uniforms marching today right now, they've been programmed. Their consciousness is surrounded around an illusion, a planned illusion, a myth. So when we start to talk about in our circles, and the kids, and we start to talk about the legacy of these individuals, these young people will start to frame who they idolize and who they want to more memorialize under a different set of rules and precepts. So, I see that we have a caller, and I think I'm going to take this caller right now. And if I'm correct, I think I know the area code, and I think I kind of know the accent. But her perspective is always welcome, and it makes Andrea's day, and it makes my day every time we know that we have loyal listeners like Sarah from Dallas. And I want to welcome Sarah onto the show. I believe it's Sarah. If I'm wrong, then If it's some cowboy from Texas, I'm sorry, sort of. But is this Sarah?
Yes, it is, Brother Solomon and Sister Andre. How are we doing this good day?
Good. How are you?
We're doing well.
I was happy when I opened my email and I saw y'all were having a program this day. How very appropriate. My first and foremost, I must say, I have to give, I must commend the ancestors, and I must keep in mind that today is the 90th anniversary of the bombing of Tulsa, Oklahoma, on Black Wall Street this weekend.
Yes.
So we have to keep in mind for those atrocities that was done at the hands of the European, where they experimented with the bomb, and we all remember that song by the Gap Band, "You Dropped the Bomb on Me." And that
yep, exactly.
done to Black Wall Street by the United States government under the disguise that some brother allegedly assaulted a white woman in an elevator, which was a lie to destroy and take away the wealth that they were jealous of these people accumulating. And these people were never compensated for it. The government never quite came out and admit their guilt that the U.S. military was used, which, of course, they always do in the homeland, against the her citizens. And this was done in 1921, this very weekend.
Yes, you're right.
So when we commemorate and we speak of the things that you talk about, Nat Turner, Denmark Vesey, and all of these great ancestors that are at rest right now, we have to think of those also, the Rosewoods and all of the other places in the U.S. where black people have, and other indigenous people, every time they try to get on their feet, this country has always strived to push them back
mm-hmm.
in a state of servitude. What I would like for you to keep in mind, people like to speak of this word America. If y'all have a pen and paper, y'all write this word down, write that name down, America. You would look within that word America is the phrase, "I am race."
Mm.
That's what name means. So you can see the philosophical outlook from these people and where they are coming from, the angle that they are coming from.
Right.
So as a someone also who has served in the military and have people currently serving in the military in these unjust wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, I also pray for their safety, and I hope that they come home very soon. And I know that it's not about protecting this country. So when I hear people telling this lie about these soldiers are out protecting the country and the welfare of the United States, it's a bunch of baloney, because being in a land 5,000 miles away is not having anything to do with your border states. These people are not going to walk across from Afghanistan or Iraq and walk into the United States. And if they do come here, it's because of aggression, as you said, the killing that's done at the hands of this president. This president, this black man sitting in the White House, has killed more people of color than the previous Bush did in his old 8 years tenure, at least in the year in last year alone, in 2010, with his drone strikes. So when people are sitting back here and they're saying, give this man a pass, he's doing the best that he can, I said, no, don't give him a pass. Why should we give him a pass? That's the whole idea why the Europeans selected this Negro and put him in there, because they know it will immobilize black people, which is what it has done. People are so proud of this black man, they can't see nothing else. And that is exactly why they put him in there.
Yep.
Because
yep.
it immobilizes people around the world of color, because they can't see beyond that. They keep saying, well, oh, you know, he's one of us. I had an argument with some Nigerians that had a picture on their wall that says with Dr. King and Obama, the realization of his dream. And I said, no, it's not.
Exactly.
I said, he is not the realization of Dr. King's dream. I said, he's more the nightmare of Dr. King's dream.
Mm-hmm.
I said,
what did they say? What was their response?
No, they don't want to argue me. I said, no. I said, let me tell you what Dr. King's dream was, not so that one black person could go into office and at the same time oppress black people all around or people of color around the globe. I said, this man, as an African with roots, who can trace his roots and his ancestry to the motherland, is destroying the continent. Under his watch, they moved AFRICOM into Djibouti.
Yes.
Under his watch, they have split the Sudan into two countries using a phony Christian versus Islam religion to split the country. on the Sudan. I keep telling them, I said they're going to move into Nigeria, and they're going to split Nigeria because they're going after the country that has oil wealth. I said, mark my word, they will go after Nigeria next. They're moving along Cote d'Ivoire. I said, that's what they're doing. They're splitting up all of these large African nations into small, manageable pieces so that they can create conflicts among the ethnic groups. And while you're fighting over nonsense, they're busy colonizing you again and taking your resources away from you. And I said, it's all under the watchful eyes of this black man with African lineage that is being done by. I said, black people have allowed themselves to be used once again as tools.
Yep. You got it right, sister.
See that, and that is exactly what they wanted to do. That's why he was selected, because they know it's going to blindside you. You're going to be so euphoric, and you will not look behind the mask to see the emperor is butt naked and doing these things on in front of you, because you're not seeing that. The same way like they do, like they like where their ministers and their preachers, like the Eddie Longs and the T.D. Jakes and all of these people, like they look at them and they uphold them, because black people have this nature, or indigenous people, period, of liking to deify people in their communities. And like I always said, whenever it comes to us as a people, we always pull these preachers, these messianic figures, and push them up there and deify them and look up to them as being saviors. We have the savior mentality about it, that somebody has to come along and save us. And that is why we've always had leaders. The leaders among us have always been preachers. And you need to ask yourself why that black people always have preachers as their leaders.
Yeah. You're right. You're right. You're right. You are so right.
Because the religion has always been used to colonize you. And that is why they've always, and they know that black people, when it comes to religion, they are the most fervent followers and worshipers of religion. So why not put a all? Why not always get a religious leader to be out there, because he can lead you straight into hell, which is what they're doing, and you would gladly follow them right on in there. So
y'all
keep doing what y'all are doing. Y'all keep waking these people up, because we've got to wake up. Then I hear this clown Tom Joyner calling Dr. Cornel West, calling him a traitor to the race. Tom Joyner is a goddamn, he's more of a traitor than Cornel West.
Yeah. Right on, man. Call him out. That's what I'm talking about.
Because you're doing something good with the HBCUs and the scholarship fund, but because you act like a damn buffoon on the radio where you have millions of people listening to you, you're not putting out information, you're putting out entertainment. You're not educating the people. Cornell is calling this man out and letting waking people up to see what this man is doing, but because y'all want to get y'all in 5-minute spot where the president would come on your radio station and say what he has to say to you, You don't want to drop him, or you don't want to stop him from coming on your program. So you're gonna come and call Cornell and Tavis out and say all these derogatory things about him, because you want, when the president gets ready to run next year and he's dropping in the polls like hot baked potato, you're gonna jump on the Michael Bay's then and the Tom Joyner show and try to rally the troops to come on and vote for him. Y'all allow yourself to be used as pimps in the community. That's why I have no respect for none of them, and I'm saying it with my own voice. Tom Joyner, Michael Bayston, Steve Harvey, Ricky Smiley, y'all are nothing but damn traitors, because y'all play all this rap buffoonery on the radio, destroying the community.
Yeah. Yeah, you're so right. They're such frauds, man. They're so listen, you're so, Sarah, and they have millions of listeners. Millions of listeners, and they could do such great things with the listenership that they have, but they sit there and to even call it black news, they play these games and like joking around and this, that, and the other, and then when they're not joking around,
give information out to the community. All they talk about is the next comedy show, the next movie, the next party, the next whatever crap they have going on in the community. They don't sit back and tell you, okay, about the Patriot Act, well, that this president Robo signed in Paris, and how it pertains to you, that this president could call on potentially pick up somebody like me, you or Andrea, and call us enemies of this country, and we can be thrown in prison without being told our rights, and our family wouldn't know where the heck we are as a part of this Patriot Act that he just signed.
Yep.
These are things that they need to be telling the community about, because we are slowly becoming into a police state, as you have said. These police officers, we are their employers. They work for us. They get paid out of our tax money. So why the hell should we have to fear them? They need to be fearing us, if we could fire their behind. But we have We have given up our power as people and let these people become the damn terrorists in our community, that they can walk into our community and shoot and kill somebody. Can you get a black police officer go somewhere up into Chevy Chase or wherever y'all live out there and kick a white person door in and come and shoot them up and say, "Oh, I'm sorry"? He wouldn't even make it out the goddamn driveway before somebody would blow his damn brains away.
Yep.
But
we allow it to continuously happen in our community, that if you come into our community and terrorize us and kill us, and we sit back and we act as if it's the normal thing of the day, and we are paying these damn people salaries.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, y'all keep waking them up. You know, this is nothing to be we need to memorialize our ancestors, lift them up on this great day, let them know that we appreciate their sacrifices. We will continue this struggle. We will continue this fight. And we will not let your blood go in vain.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you, and y'all keep up the good work that y'all are doing out there. And
thank
I will
you,
keep
sir.
Listening.
No, thank you.
I will not going to interrupt you any further because I know your times are very limited. So y'all keep, you know, waking up the masses.
Thank you, and you're always welcome, once again. Thank you.
Yep.
And you just woke up. You played your major part in waking up the masses as well. So thanks again, Sarah.
Oh, y'all are so welcome, Andre and Solomon.
Thank you. Take
all
care.
Right.
Okay, you too.
Take care. And that point I want to drive home, what I just said, is that, you know, Sarah is always welcome on the show. And folks that are listening, you're always welcome on the show. This show is for the community. We don't have corporate sponsors. Matter of fact, we pay a nominal fee every month so that we can have this platform. So call in. We want people to use it. Call in. Let your voice be heard. You know what I'm saying? Especially if it's a good take. I mean, you know, I have to say. I mean, if you're gonna come here, call in and singing, Sweet Dixie or the Pledge of Allegiance. I mean, you might want to. Most of the shows on Blog Talk Radio are actually, from a conservative perspective, you might as well call into one of those shows because I don't want to hear anything that's, you know, within the mainstream fold. But if you got something to say that's not being said outside of the mainstream construct, this is the show to do it. This is for the community. And Andre, I wanted to ask you. I want to ask you a question. I'm going to play you something, Andre. This is one of my favorite Gil Scott Heron pieces. And it belies the point when we talk about how the U.S. can find all this money to spend on military,
mm-hmm.
But at the same token, you know, we see tens of thousands of Americans dying each year because of the lack of health insurance, and they're spending all this money on military and on NASA, which now we know, we see that NASA is has been used by the U.S. military for a long, long time. They're trying to colonize space. It's becoming its own complex, if you will. And so I want to play this piece by Gil Scott Heron called Whitey on the Moon, and we'll talk about this on the other end. And a couple more people that we memorialize, Sitting Bull, and Chief Seattle, and Crazy Horse, and John Horse. You know. So anyway, much more to come. Here's Gil Scott Heron, Whitey on the Moon.
We have a poem here. It's called Whitey on the Moon. It was inspired by some whiteys on the moon. So I want to give credit where credit is due.
A rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the Moon. Her face and arms began to swell, and Whitey's on the moon. I can't pay no doctor bills, but Whitey's on the moon. 10 years from now, I'll be paying still while Whitey's on the moon. You know, the man just upped my rent last night, cause Whitey's on the moon. No hot water, no toilets, no lights, but Whitey's on the moon. I wonder why he's upping me, cause Whitey's on the moon. Well, I was already giving them 50 a week, and now Whitey's on the moon. Taxes taking my whole damn check. The junkies make me a nervous wreck. The price of food is going up. And as if all that crap wasn't enough, a rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the moon. Her face and arms began to swell, and Whitey's on the moon. With all that money I made last year for Whitey on the moon, how come I ain't got no money here? Whitey's on the moon. You know, I just about had my bill of Whitey on the moon. I think I'll send these doctor bills, air mail special. To Whitey on the moon.
Whitey on the moon. Whitey on the moon. All right, Andrea. You know, in that same vein, you know, what are your thoughts on the whole realm of this military industrial complex and not just the lives that it takes directly through a military conflict, but also the lives that it takes from the robbing of things that have been sickly called entitlement programs. But as we know, there are social programs that are desperately needed. Planned Parenthood, we know, you know, Planned Parenthood is not just about abortions. Planned Parenthood is so much more than that. You know, we look at, Medicare, which is now being attacked. We look at a universal health care program that does not exist, that needs to be allowed. Well, what's your context on that? And because I see that as murder as well. When you're taking oxygen from, If I'm taking oxygen from you and I put a plastic bag over somebody's head, I'm taking valuable oxygen that you need to live from you. So to me, what I see them doing is they're using their political might and taking metaphoric oxygen by way of desperately needed health care from people and children and babies that need it. No?
Right, absolutely. I mean, everything that Gil Scott Heron is talking about in this poem is still happening today. You know, in D.C., 2 out of every $3 are being cut from social programs. So from WIC, which provides working class women with money to pay for the food, for their food and for food for their babies. From TANF, which is support to pay their rent. From Medicaid, all these different, you know, insurance plans that come with Medicaid are having their own battles and splitting up or just completely being cut. So now you have, like, a bunch of people trying to get on one type of insurance, these constant switches. And I say this because I work in a clinic, and I see these changes happening every day and how people keep calling and asking for services and there's only so, like, there's just cuts. I mean, and it's already bad enough because things are already, money's already limited. These programs are already short-staffed and can't meet the number of people that need to be served. And now $2 out of $3 are being cut from social programs and no taxes are being increased for the rich. And, you know, it's crazy. What are you saying? Like, there's so much money to put into NASA. There's so much money to go to the war. Like you always say, more than half of the money that we spend from taxes goes into the military. Meanwhile, we have to continue to cut social programs. It's just outrageous. And you know, I was hearing some coverage also about DC that. This would also affect homeless shelters. So homeless shelters would be closed more than half the year. They're already closed a good portion of the year. It's already limited as it is. So them being closed even more is just going to have more people on the streets, more people starving, more people. It's going to increase crime because people got to eat. And people have to understand that people don't choose to be poor and people don't choose to to, like, be in these situations where they might have to rob to eat. But when it comes down to it, I'd like one person to tell me that they wouldn't do what they had to do if they had to feed their families. I feel like people don't really put themselves in the situation of if they were in that person's shoes, what would you do, you know? And sit here and tell me that you wouldn't do what you had to do to feed your family. And so it's just, I mean, you know, these things are still happening. Meanwhile, you know, there's still money for cocktail parties for people on Capitol Hill, you know, time after time, but there's no money for basic needs to feed children that are just born, to have them, their mothers not have to worry about a $5,000 bill, a hospital bill after they give birth, all those types of things. So definitely.
And, you know, just wanted to say that when the U.S., you know, because I know nothing else to add, you know, beyond that. That was, you know, perfect. But actually, I want to, you know, take a moment to welcome on for the next several minutes Stephen Lindman, who writes for a number of different websites. You know, he has his own blog. You can find, he has his own radio show. It's at, you know, just go to progressiveradionetwork.com and go to the Progressive News Hour. And you can find Stephen Lindman's his radio show. He lives in Chicago. He can be reached at lindmanstephen@sbcglobal.net. But it, you know, just go to any of his pieces. All his information is at the bottom. But he, you know, he's one of those writers out there that uses his scholarship that he acquired on his own, the best kind of scholarship that didn't come from classrooms, but scholarship that he acquired on his own and was able to read between the lines. And he, as I said before, he's one of the most prolific writers I know. Puts out one or two pieces daily. But he's just written a piece today that that it's called Memorial and Veterans Day Hypocrisy. Memorial and Veterans Day Hypocrisy. And you can find that on his blog, but you can also find it on yourworldnews.org with many of his other pieces. And he's on the line, and I want to welcome Stephen on. And I want to start off by asking Stephen why this piece and what does he mean? What hypocrisy? What is the hypocrisy surrounding Veterans Day and Memorial Day, which we're in right now? So, Stephen, you're on with Andre and Solo.
Oh, thanks, Solo. Thank you. It's awfully good being on with you again. I literally woke up. So many mornings I wake up, Solo, and I end up writing about something that was not on my mind when I roll out of bed. I spot something, and it just triggers something in my mind. Well, I know that today is Memorial Day, and this morning I found an editorial in the New York Times on Memorial Day, and I scanned through it. And there was not a word in that editorial really explaining what on earth wars are all about and why they're fought and the kids that go over and die for the wrong reasons. And, you know, I mean, what else would you expect from the New York Times or the U.S. media or the Western media? And then I went and I checked for some other editorials, and they were pretty much the same thing. With one exception, it was almost like a throwaway line. At the end of a Washington Post editorial, it was dated the 29th of May, and I found it this morning online, and they mentioned the same kind of boilerplate reflections of, you know, America's fallen heroes and that sort of stuff. And they had a line, they mentioned the last recently living Medal of Honor winner in the state of Maryland, close to the Washington, D.C. area, where the Post is headquartered, and a man named Wiedendorfer, and he died on the 25th of May. And they mentioned a comment. It was actually, I think, an interview that he gave a few years earlier. And here's a guy who won the Medal of Honor, I believe, in the Battle of the Bulge in World War II. something I know a little bit about, but it's been a long time since I've made any comments. It was a very bloody battle, and I took a quick look at what he did. It was recklessly heroic is one way to describe it. But here's what his line was. This literally was about the last line in the editorial. Again, it was like a throwaway because, you know, some people don't even get to the last line. And the last line was this, a direct quote. Wouldn't it be wonderful? I mean, this breaks me up to read this. Wouldn't it be wonderful if the Medal of Honor didn't exist because there were no wars and we could all live in peace? I mean that really hits me hard. I said, did the Washington Post really print this? And my next line was, really ever do America's media express that sentiment? Never its warrior leaders. And then I quoted what Obama said in a 2011 proclamation on Memorial Day. Well, what would you expect him to say? Well, that's exactly what he said. And my response, you know, it's very smooth and it sounds like it's the right thing, but it's so hypocritical. And then I quoted a couple of paragraphs, short paragraphs from him, and then I added my own thought, just citing the hypocrisy, saying, waging multiple imperial wars, readying plans for others, and numerous proxy ones. His hypocrisy requires no comment. Desecrating the graves he pretends to honor. And that's exactly what he did. But everybody else does it too. And then I wrote about, I mean the shame of the commemorations honoring the nation's dead on Memorial Day is for the dead, and Veterans Day is for those gone and those still living, the veterans. And I gave a little bit about the history of both, how they started, and updated it today. Maybe I can just read a couple of lines. Here's one paragraph that I read. Let me get this in, solo, and then you comment. And if listeners are on, I'd be happy to take any comments from them, whatever time you can give me. But here's what I said, reflecting on both days. I said, both days, in fact, dishonor America's war dead, omitting why they fought and died in vain, sacrificing their lives for imperial conquest, plunder, and new ones in an endless cycle of gratuitous violence, militarism, brutality, and destruction for power and profit. And I had lots of other lines similar to that.
Right. Andre, I know you had something. I mean, that's a powerful piece, and it was powerful when I first read it, Stephen. I know Andrea, who's on the line right now, has a comment or a question for you, you know, based on what you read and written and just said. Andrea?
I want to thank you for coming on the show and talking about that article, because it's so important to have those perspectives that, there's so much hypocrisy in everything that's going on. And everything that the U.S. says, whether it's a representative of the government or the president himself, always, you know, it's just outrageous that he got the Nobel Peace Prize and he says things like this, and he can talk a certain way and try to make it seem like that him and the United States are behind a peace process and bringing freedom and liberty to people around the world, but then you see exactly what his agenda is, and what laws he passes, what his foreign policy is like. And so I think it's so important that people write about this and show it for what it is. And so I appreciate everything you just shared, because it's true.
Oh, Andrea, thank you so much. I always say ignore the rhetoric and watch the policy, and the policy always belies the rhetoric. He's a man, and not just him. I mean, George Bush did it, and Clinton did it, and Bush won, and Reagan. I mean, they all do it. They all
right.
Preach peace and wage war. How can you call yourself a peace when you're waging war? And Gore Vidal wrote a book on it. Another historian did too, decades before Gore Vidal did. And I think the titles were exactly the same. If I remember the precise title, they both said, A Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace. You know, we're fighting endless wars, and we're always fighting them for peace that is unattainable. And it's like 1984 that Orwell wrote about in the 1950s.
Yeah.
And I said this in one interview that I had not all that long ago, that, you know, America is like Oceania in 1984, and we have the same kind of enemies. So in 1984, it was Emmanuel Goldstein. He was public enemy number one. And for America, it was bin Laden until we went through the falsity of supposedly killing him for the second time. Well, we never killed him the first time. I mean, he died a natural death, as far as we know. But, he was public enemy number one. So there'll be another public enemy number one. Before him was Saddam back in 1990. And of course, the Cold War, the evil empire. And it goes from one to another to another to another. And when we don't have enemies, we invent them, because we need to scare the public. How else can we do these horror things around the world? You can't fight wars unless you scare people. And it was a long time ago that I quoted a guy who really understood this very well, and that was Hermann Göring. Well, Joseph Goebbels understood it even better. It was propaganda,
yeah, exactly.
Chief.
Right.
But before Göring took his life at Nuremberg, he was interviewed by a prison psychologist, and the psychologist asked him, how did you ever get the German people to go along with what you wanted to do? And he gave a long answer, but he was right on the mark, and he said things like, you can't convince ordinary people to leave their families and go fight on a battlefield. You know, farmers, I mean they want to farm, they don't want to go fight. So the only way you can get them to go along with this stuff is to scare the hell out of them. Well, we always said the Russians are coming. I don't know what Goebbels said, but he said the equivalent of the Russians are coming. I mean, you just scare the hell out of people, and your government is only acting to protect you. Well, we do the exact same thing. So we had the false flag 9/11 attack, and people were terrified. And they wanted Bush to go get the bad guys. So we went to Afghanistan, and we went to Iraq. It's pretty tough to say why we're going to Libya, but, you know, we're finagling that one as well, and we just keep doing this from one war to another war to another war, and on a day like this, honoring the wasted lives that never should have died, that all presidents, not just Obama, all presidents will give a public statement, a public proclamation, honoring the dead and proclaiming an intention to work for peace. And it's all a pack of lies, no matter who says it.
You're right on. I mean, I couldn't, you know, yeah, you're right on.
Can I read what I said?
Go on.
I said, you know, instead of working for peace, I said, in fact, what these wars are, they're for wealth and power, nothing else, conquering, colonizing, and exploiting resources and people ruthlessly, shifting from one theater to another, satisfying an insatiable desire for more, sucking life out of countries one at a time or several simultaneously, an American tradition from inception, a little more. As a result, these holidays warrant special condemnation, representing a galling legacy of perpetual wars, false patriotism, and unattainable peace. The very notion, intolerable to America's leaders for generations, notably since World War II, and is that ever true?
Right on,
Stephen. I wanted this thing to hit hard. I hope I did it, and I got some very fast, nice feedback in the morning, and including from a couple of interesting people, and I hope more comes. And I can only wish the people in power would read it, even though it wouldn't make any difference at all. You know, it would roll right off their back like nothing. You know, like water off a duck's back, as they say. But to let them know that, you know, they may fool some of the people, but they're not fooling us all.
Exactly. And that's what we got to do. We got to do what you're doing, and we have to continue to press on and speak out. You know, no matter. how big or small our audiences may be. You know, we never know where our articles or our shows are going to reach, and without a doubt, you know, I'm sure that your article is going to reach some people who have not heard this perspective from this vantage point before, and that's a victory in and of itself, because that's one more person who has, you know, allowed themselves just to be transformed from, you know, being, you know, obsequious to the empire and the emperor, you know, himself, to being, you know, a follower, being someone that was anti-war, but at the same time, pro-peace. You know, Obama is neither. He's neither. Bush was neither. You know, and so, you know, I thank you so much for your piece. I really do.
Oh, yeah, I think it's important, Solo, because the real agenda of America, like all other imperial powers before us, and we're the most powerful by far. And if the world survives, maybe the one that comes after us will be more powerful. But the agenda is always the same: more conquest, more wealth, more power, literally insatiable. And you just simply can't satisfy these people. And they just want to turn one country after another into an empty hulk, literally stealing all of its wealth, its resources, then moving on to the next target, over and over again, justifying it by the false explanation that these people, these countries, their leaders, their regimes, they threaten our security. Nobody threatens America's security. No country, no leader in his or her right mind would ever dream of attacking America. But every country justifiably should live in terror that America may decide to attack them. And we attack so many, why not? Another may come up because they're not exactly in line with our policies. And what kind of a country calls itself a democracy and carries on like this? And I think less of who the leadership may be at any time, Solo, and more about what I call the power structure, and the power structure and what they want and what they demand, and what they literally buy in the people that they make sure get into the high positions in government. The power structure wants these things, and what the power structure wants is what it usually gets. And they put the people in to carry out the policies they want. And if they make a mistake once in a while, they try to find a way to get rid of those people. So they made a mistake with Kennedy, and they got rid of him. And that was a lesson well learned. But they got rid of Martin Luther King, not because of his civil rights movement. They were willing to go along with that. What they feared was he wanted to get us out of Vietnam. Well, that was that I suspect was Kennedy's worst quote unquote sin. He wanted, after he escalated a little bit, he wanted to pull U.S. forces out of Vietnam before we even got the war started. And I think that was the main reason they killed him. There were other reasons as well, and Martin Luther King as well. If I remember right, Solo, a year to the day before he was assassinated, he gave his speech where he condemned the Vietnam War. And I wish I had his quote or quotes in front of me. I mean, he was such a brilliant orator and a magnificent leader, which is so absent today. But you get someone with the power that he resonated, getting behind something, and that literally could have the effect of marshaling many millions of people around the country to join him in what he felt was right, convincing them that this is what we have to do. So the only way to stop him was to kill him, and they killed him.
Right. You're right. Yeah. And what's interesting is if Stephen he lived, the letter that he sent his father outlining the title of his next speech, and we know that he you know, he didn't live. He was killed by the U.S. government on April 4, 1968. But had he lived, the title of his next speech was "Why America May Go to Hell." This was outlined in a letter that he sent to his father, and it was and they discussed this in the past documentary that was done by Tavis Fowley and PBS over a year ago. "Why America May Go to Hell," and we can only imagine what that speech would have what he would have discussed in that speech, we'll never know.
If he had lived, he'd be a very old man now. I forget exactly how old he'd be. He'd be pretty well up in years. But just imagine if we had had him all through the years on the public stage making these kinds of speeches and rallying people. I mean, he was the driving force behind the civil rights movement. There were other good people involved as well, but you needed a real strong, capable leader like he was. They don't come along very often, Solo. And I look around today, and there's no Martin Luther King. We need another Martin Luther King. I don't care what race or ethnicity he is, or it could be a woman just as well as a man. We need somebody with the power and influence that he resonated talking about the right things, getting out the right messages, and that's sorely lacking. So we have a state in the country where people are more focused on bread and circuses than on such important issues that affect their lives so adversely now. And this has to be pointed out to people, and you have to keep drumming it into their heads to make them realize, you know, the government you think I don't know what you think they're doing, but you don't understand how much harm they're causing. And the harm they're causing is touching your lives directly. And it's up to us to act against this. And if we don't do it, it's only going to get worse and worse and worse. And we need someone like Martin Luther King to hammer that point home over and over again. If there's anybody out there that has that kind of talent, I sure hope they're going to make themselves evident before too long.
Right. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for calling in, Stephen. And we know this won't be the last time, but thank you so much. And thank you for being so prolific, but also making sure that all of your articles have such weight and substance to them. You know, they're all, you know, heavy pieces that that are not in vain. I can tell you that right now. They're not in vain. So thank you.
They come from the heart, Solo. I'll leave it at that, and I thank you for giving me a little time. I'll let you get on and get some other people on, but it was great being on with you a little bit today, just talking about this article that became so important to me to get out and the message. Thanks, Solo. Thanks, Andrew.
Oh, no problem.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. Yeah, that was good, and his piece was right on. It's always good to hear from Stephen. Andrea, you said you wanted to memorialize another person. I mean, I don't want to say one more person because there are too many to give the respect that they deserve in a 2-hour show. So perhaps we'll continue to make a point of it to memorialize at least somebody each show from here on out. But you said you wanted to memorialize one more person for this program.
Right. Yeah. There are so many people that need to be mentioned. But I just wanted to end on my behalf with someone who really impacted my life when I was in my early years in college. Her name is Comandante Ramona. She was an officer of the Zapatista Army of the National Liberation, which is a revolutionary indigenous organization in Mexico, in the state of Chiapas. And she's one of the most prominent women known in the Zapatista Party because she played a very early role in the uprising. And so, when I learned about the movement, just the movement in general, it was incredible. But just to see another woman to identify with, that she was really small. Her rifle was probably 3/4 of her body, but she was a soldier. She was incredible in what she did, and she was always by Comandante Marcos's side. He's often seen as the face of the movement, but like he says, he's a spokesperson. He's not indigenous himself, but he's really integrated himself into the Zapatista movement. But she really led the way for a lot of the women and organizing a lot of the women and bringing equality and dignity for these women and for the children. And so it's someone that I really respect and value. And I think that oftentimes when we talk about heroes, it's often men who are memorialized, and there definitely have been a tremendous amount of men who should be memorialized, but I think that oftentimes women aren't honored in the same way, and so I wanted to end with her and the impact that she had on my life.
Right. Well, thank you. You know, so much for that, and you know, because it brings up the bigger point is that you know there are a lot of folks right now that you know, it seems like they're on an island, but there are a lot of folks right now worldwide, throughout the U.S. as well as, and you know, in relationship to the general population, yes, they may be a very small, scant minority, but there are people out there right now that are doing, you know, yeoman's work when it comes to liberation and social justice and true social justice that is centered around a 360 degree viewpoint of social justice. Because I know a lot of folks who, you know, may be a social justice advocate on one issue, but then on another issue, they may, you know, they may be, you know, totally indifferent to what's going on in, say, for instance, Palestine, you know, because they're too chicken shit to question, you know, the repressive, oppressive, and human life destructive impact that Israel is having on countless Palestinians, not just in Gaza or West Bank, but also in East Jerusalem, and we also know that, you know, they Golan Heights is also an Israel colony, and so you know, I'm talking about the real people out there, the real people who are social justice advocates across the board. You know, mm-hmm. I give two shits about you know, pumping up, you know, as Sarah said, you know, about Barack Obama because he's a brown face with this, that, and the other. You know, I'm so glad I never, I'm so happy I never voted for this dude, because honestly, if I had voted for him, you know, I'm certain that I would have been upset with him now as I am, you know, with him now, you know. But I would feel like I needed to constantly, like, just give myself a cold shower that I voted for that guy, and thank goodness I didn't vote for him. I voted for Cynthia McKinney, and I'm proud of it. And I voted for her when people even around me, you know, were like, oh, you know, why, I can't vote. Yeah, you're right, Solomon. And you know, her stance is such and such. But I don't want my vote to be wasted. I'm going to go to the polls, and I'm going to vote for Barack Obama. And despite the fact that I told them what's going on, I said, mark my words, I guarantee you, this guy is going to be much of the same with Bush. Oh yeah, no, he's not. He's just doing what it takes to get elected. And right as I said, I'm not Nostradamus. I did the opposite of what all those people that voted for Barack Obama, every single last one of them that voted for him, what I did is I looked at his voting record and I examined him, and I didn't get caught up in the fury and the mental programming. All right, and so folks out there, you know, allow yourselves to be unhooked mentally from the mental programming. All right, you know, I'm not trying to call people out. You know who you are that stepped forward and voted for him. All right, okay, and you know, you have your work to do, as we speak, to break up this monotony of this empire. All right, because as you can see, this brown face that has the same politics as Bush and Clinton and Reagan, who he friggin' loves, Reagan, you know, ain't nothing. You know, their vote was a wasted vote. Mine was not. Their vote was a wasted vote. So with that being said, I'm going to let Gil Scott-Heron take us out. You know, thanks for joining us on Your World News. Thanks again, Andrea, for coming on. Look forward
Thank
to doing
you.
The next show with you as well. And those of you out there right now, this show is dedicated to every freedom fighter out there, living and deceased right now. The struggle goes on. We must fight for justice, and we must be unwavering in our fight for justice. So here's Gil Scott-Heron with Home Is Where the Hatred Is.
A junkie walking through the twilight, I'm on my way home. I left 3 days ago, but no one seems to know I'm gone. Home is where the hatred is. Home is filled with pain, and it might not be such a bad idea if I never went home again. Stand as far away from me as you can and ask me why. Hang on to your rosy beads, close your eyes to watch me die. You keep saying, kick it, quit it, kick it, quit it, God, but did you ever try to turn your sick soul inside out so that the world, so that the world can watch you die? If I never went home.